History has accelerated. I believe that once again it will be the human mind that will notice this acceleration, give it a name, and transform those words into deeds. Thank you.
Václav Havel's relationship to the United States is the focus of the recently issued book Havel v Americe, or Havel in America, by historian Rosamund Johnston and journalist Lenka Gabrielova. Mainly based on Q&A-style interviews, it contains insights and anecdotes from Bill Clinton, Madeleine Albright, both Presidents Bush, and a host of others, and is the first publication to concentrate on the subject. When I met the authors, I first asked Rosie Johnston about the genesis of Havel v Americe.
With this oral history project, we spoke to 10 people about their connections to Havel, and some really interesting things came up. But it was just about, I suppose, sharing that information with people in this country who wouldn't necessarily know about it because it was in English, for example, and it was archived in American university libraries. So it was just about, I suppose, presenting this information here.
And Lenka, you interviewed several of these people. How did you get access to the likes of Bill Clinton?
A huge thanks belongs to Pavla Niklova from the Havel Library in New York, because she made an extreme effort to reach the people. Some of that was pulled together by, you know, my journalistic contacts as well, and we kind of joined forces, all of us. And as Rosie said, the book, kind of the intention to publish it here, I published several of the interviews here on the Czech radio in Czech, but they were not in full length because those were oral histories, which took hour and a half sometimes, sometimes more, sometimes a little bit less. It depends. Bill Clinton didn't have 3 hours for us, but still, he was pretty generous with his time. And it was really a nice idea, I think, to reach the Czech audience and to actually present the whole length of the oral histories, which are accessible in English for them.
Havel famously, in February 1990, visited the US for the first time as president, and he made the speech to the joint session of Congress. What was his main message in that speech, in that address, and what impact did it have on how he was perceived in the States?
Massive impact, and you can still see it through the oral history. It's one of the main lines that goes through all of them. People generally mention it as an extremely interesting moment and a real selfless moment of a person who comes from this small country which suffered, and then he's approaching and addressing Congress, this really mighty body in the US, and he's not asking for anything for the Czech Republic or for Czechoslovakia then. He's asking them to deal with Russia and to help Russia. And he says, well, if you help Russia, you can help us as well. Which for many, like Bill Clinton, like Madeleine Albright, like others, that was an ultimate sign of A, Havel's philosophies, but B, also the nature of his policies and of the fact that he wasn't just thinking about the small insular Czech Republic or Czechoslovakia. He was just thinking in broad terms about kind of global politics.
Also from the American side, this and Havel's other visits to the States are these interesting moments in American history of bipartisan cooperation. So a lot of this book talks about sort of America today and, I suppose, the divides in America today. Time and again, interviewees from all sides of the political spectrum said that he was really a figure who united Americans, Republicans with Democrats. And that joint session is a moment where he got applause from everyone and he was speaking across party lines.
On that famous trip to the States, in New York at the St. John the Divine Cathedral, there was some kind of event for Havel. I've seen photos of the guests who were there, people like Richard Gere, Cindy Crawford, Tim Robbins, Susan Sarandon. Obviously, it was a hot ticket. Why was there such kind of celebrity interest in this Havel fella?
So I don't know the answer to that, but I would point to a moment in Madeleine Albright's interview where she talks about at one point she brought Robert Redford to Prague. And they went around Prague together, and she said it was really interesting to see him out of his more traditional after the revolution guise as president and as a man of the stage again. She reminds us, as a few of the interviewees do, that he started in the theatre, he had an affinity with actors, and he really spoke to them in a different way. And so she talks about, I suppose, his ease and his happiness in those surroundings.
I think it's interesting that it comes up from the interviews that he really had some sort of a rock star quality to him. And people wanted to be around him. Bill Luhrs talks about it. Bill Clinton talks about it. that he had this sort of, even though he seemed shy and he was kind of a little bit distant and he wasn't this classic person who you would think as this outgoing, you know, brilliant person, he still was attracting people and they were naturally drawn to him. And maybe added to that the fact that, you know, he was from an oppressed country and he was this, I think in American sense, and that's only my assumption, I don't know, but, you know, in the idea of American idealism that good eventually, you know, beats the bad guys, he was the embodiment of the good guys.
Doesn't Peter Pinhard say in the introduction something along the lines of that it was a fairy tale that had appealed to Americans,
yeah,
that he had gone from being a prisoner to the throne?
Yes, it's a lovely kind of American fairy tale, but also a lot of Americans maybe wished they could be him and knew they couldn't, right? Because it does take these dissident qualities, this really standing up for what you believe in an environment that is very difficult to, I suppose, be persecuted for what you believe in. And so he talks about how many people wrote for the New York Review of Books and kind of wished that they could be this sort of philosopher or president, but in American conditions, that's just not possible.
In the book, you have interviews with people like the two President Bushes, Clinton, of course, Madeleine Albright, Henry Kissinger, many others. What are the adjectives that they keep offering to describe Havel?
Humble. Humble, I think, is the number one adjective that people use, but that he was able to combine strength with being humble is something that a lot of the interviewees kind of puzzle over and return to. And relevant, I suppose, would be another adjective that they would use. They kept on suggesting that they continue to read Havel's political writings to understand what's going on in the United States today, and as discussed before, this increasing polarization of the United States today.
Of all the interviewees, which for you offers the most interesting insights into Havel and the US?
Well, that's a tough one because I think those are two maybe different sets of issues, but then both of them are really in an interesting way combined in Bill Loris's interview, because Bill Loris really knew Václav Havel already in the 80s. He was an ambassador to Czechoslovakia in 1983 to 1987, I think, and he knew Havel since the very beginning. He was inviting him to the residence and he was talking to him, and he really has an interesting view, which is by far we were a little bit afraid so that it wouldn't turn into hagiography and to some like book, you know, talking about Havel only in superlatives. So Bill Loris can be critical, and he, in a very philosophical way, he has a real polemic with Havel's ideas and thoughts and philosophical ideas, which I think are very interesting and relevant to use the word today. And even if you think about the US in today's kind of light.
So I suppose two interviews that immediately spring to mind for me. The first I really enjoyed working on after a link I had recorded with Timothy Snyder, who probably knew Havel the least well. So this wouldn't actually be, it's not a great reflection on like what Havel was like in the 80s and the 70s, because he just doesn't know and he doesn't even really want to speak about that, which he doesn't know. But he also, like Loris, was sometimes tremendously critical of Havel's decisions in office, while at the same time stressing the relevance of Havel's political thought and political writing for politics in the United States and Central Europe today. And then, of course, I'm biased. I loved speaking to Paul Wilson, who is another individual who'd known Havel. He had known him since the 60s and could talk about living here and being involved in not yet codified as dissident circles, but circles that would go on to be understood as dissident circles in the 70s and so on. And then he also, as Havel's translator, could speak very interestingly about kind of the difficulties of translating and transmitting Havel's ideas to a North American audience. And of course, the changing status of Havel when he became president and much better known.
Was there anything that surprised you or that you learned about Havel in the process of putting together this book?
In a way, more human touch and more human dimension, which is surprising because you talk to politicians and you would expect them to be very rigid and, you know, very kind of philosophical or very theoretical, and it's not at all. And you can tell that Havel really impacted them as a person, and they name human qualities. And that is one interesting angle for me of all of these conversations, that you see that, you know, big international relations and big historic relations and shifts, they are eventually results of human interactions. And you can tell from the book that this was the case.
Yeah, I think you just said it really nicely. One of the hypotheses that we went into the project with is that foreign policy is actually about personal contact. And, you know, I'm a historian, and very often when you access foreign policy decisions as a historian is documents in an archive that's sort of old and dusty, etc. And we were interested in seeing how those documents come to be made. And we did find, as we supposed, that, I mean, it might sound dreadful, but that they start with barbecues in Connecticut at Milos Forman's house, or that they start with dinner parties in Georgetown, you know, with Hillary and Bill Clinton in 1991. That sort of perhaps reinforces an idea that politics is an elite club of a small group of people, but also decision-making, yeah, is based on friendships, conversations, and the cultivation of those friendships and conversations.
There was one thing that I took away from the book more than anything else, which was that Kissinger, Henry Kissinger, who said that he met Havel for the first time through Milos Forman, he says that when he first spoke to Havel after 89, that Havel was not in favor of joining NATO. He was against any kind of military alliance. Then he says a year later, Havel had changed his mind completely. Did you find any corroborating evidence for this? Is this true? Do you know?
So, in fact, it seems like the book actually would put into doubt Kissinger's statement, right? There are some inconsistencies in this book, as there are going to be when you are dealing with people's memories of what took place about 30 years ago. Kissinger does suggest more or less that he's responsible for changing Havel's mind and joining NATO, which is exactly, like Bill Lures said, exactly the opposite. And even Bill Clinton would tell the opposite story in the book. And I think that's just a really good reminder that these are important historical sources, but this shouldn't be read as how it really happened and the truth. This is what people have to say about Havel now 30 years on, and maybe how they reappraise their own role in the reorientation of Czechoslovakia to the West.
The book's been out for a while here. Obviously, it's targeted at Czech readers. What kind of response have you got, or what kind of things are people telling you that they've got from the book?
I actually am really humbled, to use the word again, by the overall positive reception of the book. People seem to appreciate that there is a different look at Havel, which is from abroad, which, especially in these times when you see small Central European countries getting more and more insular, it might seem, or at least I got the reaction that it's refreshing and that it's a reminder why it's worth being more worldly and outgoing, and how important good personal relationships and kind of cultivation and cultivated relationships, why they are important.
I suppose I'm delighted that people are suggesting that they're learning new things, or that there are more details still to be learned about how Havel was received in America, because as Link has said, a lot of these individuals have already been frequently on Czech radio or Czech television talking about their relationship to Havel, but that these oral histories maybe go into more depth and go into, I suppose, the minutiae, but the important minutiae of the kind of fame he enjoyed there and the relationships he had there.
I know both of you have spent a lot of time in the States in recent years. What's your perception of how Havel is seen there today?
I would say that everyone we speak to really is of one generation. Timothy Snyder would be one of the youngest. So I think that he continues to be a very important symbol and a very important character and a very important thinker of people who, Timothy Snyder describes himself as a member of the last Cold War generation. So people who were born and raised during the Cold War, I think, look to him still as someone who can even shed light on current American political dysfunction and what to do in a situation in which you might feel powerless. I don't know if he appeals to a younger generation, though Peter Pithart, in his introduction, would suggest that he managed to captivate young Americans too, and maybe you can speak to this better.
Yeah, I was actually just thinking about it. It really depends who you ask. When you ask the older generation or the generation which still remembers Cold War, yes, definitely Havel is a relevant person. And especially, like as Rosie said, Timothy Snyder used his thoughts in writing his newer books. So that's one thing. The other thing is young generation, though I think it would be unfair to expect the young generation to know about Havel because they grew up in a completely different set of events and, you know, geopolitical events. But I think with, you know, with Donald Trump and with the polarization and with everything what we talk about in the US, Havel, indeed, as Pithart reminds us in his intro, he would and he could be still a relevant person if only people come across him.